meeting, chapter four. Second meeting, chapter four. If you are visiting with us or you just joined the class today, we want to welcome you. We are in 2 Kings, and we're doing a study on the kings and the prophets. And what we've learned is that the kingdom of God, the people of God, were ruled by three kings. First, King Saul, second, King David, and then third, King Solomon. And as a result of Solomon's disobedience, God split the kingdom in half between a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom. And in the north, 10 tribes of Israel lived there, and in the south, 2 tribes lived there. And these tribes were at odds with each other. They were basically enemies, but on occasion, they would join together to fight a common enemy, like Syria. And in the midst of the rule of these kings, there are prophets that come on the scene, and we're looking today at the prophet Elisha. And the year is about 840 BC, and Elisha is the advisor to the king of the north, but as often is the case, kings and presidents and potentates don't take good advice. And when they don't take good advice, they get into trouble. And so Elisha offers advice, but oftentimes the king does not take it. So we're going to look today in chapters 4 through 6, and we're going to see a string of miracles that God does through Elisha to demonstrate his power to the people of Israel and the surrounding nations. Now, miracle number 1 is found at the beginning of chapter 4, and here's what it says. A certain woman, this is 2 Kings 4:1, a certain woman of the wives of the sons of the prophets cried out to Elisha, saying, "Your servant, my husband, is dead. And you know that your servant feared the Lord. And the creditor is coming to take my 2 sons to be his slaves." Now, from last week, we learned that Elisha is the head or the master of a school of the prophets. This is a training institution, if you will, that trains young men to hear the voice of God and proclaim that message to their nation. And evidently, this woman's husband was one of the students, called a son of a prophet. And he's died. And he's left a widow, 2 children, and a large debt, and now his 2 children are going to be taken as slaves because of his debt. And so what happens is the woman cries out to Elisha. Who else is she going to turn to? That was her husband's boss, her husband's mentor. She says, "You need to help me. This is an urgent situation." So in verse 2 it says, "So Elisha said to her, 'What shall I do for you? Tell me, what do you have in the house?' And she said, 'Your maidservant has nothing in the house, but a jar of oil.'" Now this implies that Elisha had little resources as well, because she cries out, she says, "Elisha, help me," and he says, "What do you want me to do? What do you have in your house?" The implication is, "I don't have anything." And this shows you that Elisha is a man who's living by faith. For his needs to be met, he has to trust the Lord. He's not getting a paycheck every week. He doesn't own property. He's a man of God. And so when he says, "What can I do for you?" the implication is, "What can I do for you? What do you have in your house?" He said, "Well, the only thing I got is a jar of oil. And that's not going to get my sons, can't buy my sons out of slavery for that jar of oil." And then he said in verse 3, "Well, go borrow vessels from everywhere, from your neighbors, empty vessels. Do not gather just a few. And when you come in, you shall shut the door behind you and your sons, and then you and your sons, and then pour it into the vessels. Pour the oil into those borrowed vessels and set aside the full ones." And so she went with him, and she shut the door behind her and her sons, and she brought the vessels to her, and she poured it in. Now it came to pass that when the vessels were full from that one jar of oil, she said, hey, you got some empty pans? Neighbor said, sure. Got some jars and pans. And she borrows all these vessels from her neighbors. And Elisha says, pour that one jar of oil into all the vessels. And she pours it. She fills up, and that jar is on it. And she pours it in another vessel, and that jar is on it. And that's what you have happening here. And so it came to pass that the vessels were full, in verse 6. And she said to her son, bring me another vessel. And he said to her, there's not another vessel. And so all the oil ceased. At that point, it didn't keep multiplying. There was nothing else to put it in. And then she came and she told the man of God, and he said, go sell all that oil and pay your debt, and you and your sons live on the rest. And so this is miracle number one that demonstrates the power of God. He has absolutely nothing to offer her except a word from God. This isn't his word. This is God's word. And she, in faith, acts in obedience and does what he says. Now she should have said, that's the craziest thing I've ever heard. I ask you to help me, you tell me to go borrow vessels. That's what I would have said. Wouldn't you? Let's be honest with each other. And yet, that's what he tells her. And this woman believes him. This shows you the faith they had in Elisha, the head of the school of the prophets. This was a man who had mastered hearing from God. And so when he spoke with authority. And so she takes him in his word, does it, and sure enough, there is a miracle. Sort of sounds like Jesus turning the water into wine, doesn't it? What did Elisha touch? Let me ask you, what did he touch? Did he touch anything? Didn't touch anything. She did all this. When Jesus told the servants to pour the water into the big jars, did Jesus touch anything? Didn't touch a thing. But see, Jesus gave the instructions because he had a word from God. And he knew what God wanted to happen there. And so here we have this miracle of multiplication. Now, miracle number two is found in verse 8. We'll look at 4 or 5 of the miracles today. Now, I want you to notice the difference in the setting. Okay? The difference in the setting. Verse 8. And so it happened one day that Elisha went to Shunem, where there was a notable woman, or a great woman, and she persuaded him to eat some food. And so it was, as often as he passed by, he would turn in there to eat some food. Now, this is an act of hospitality. Here's the man of God, and he's in his travels. This shows you how he was cared for. He didn't have a job. He was cared for by people's hospitality. This woman sees him coming. She invites him in. And she says, hey, anytime you're in the neighborhood, stop in and eat. And so he does. He stops in and eats. And she said to her husband, verse 9, look now, I know this is a holy man of God who passes by us regularly. Please, let us make a small upper room on the wall, and let us put a bed for him there, and a table and a chair and a lampstand. And so it will be, whenever he comes to us, he can turn in there. She says, let's fix up a guest room for him. Every time he passes by, comes through town, and she was living in an area, Shunem, which was an area where the tribe of Issachar reigned, lived. And he would go around to visit all the schools of the prophets and so on and so forth. He said, let's fix up a guest room. And so it happened, verse 11, that one day that he came there and he turned into the upper room and he lay down and he said to his servant, Gehazi, call the Shunammite woman. And when he called her, she stood before him. And he said to his servant, now say to her, look, you've been concerned for us with all this care. What can I do for you? You want me to speak on your behalf to the king or to the commander of the army? Now, I want you to notice the setting. In the first setting, you have a widow woman. In this setting, you have a married woman. In the first setting, you have a very poor woman. She is a widow and has no means of surviving. Here you have a woman in verse One who's described as a notable woman, a great woman, a woman of wealth. And so this is a very influential woman, a woman that has a lot of respect. The other woman has no wealth at all. She's a wife of a minister, basically. And so that's what you have here. Now he says, what can I do for you? Now he's talking, humanly speaking. He said, you've done something for me. You've fixed up rooms. You've given me something to eat. Now what can I do for you? Can I talk to the king? That's humanly speaking. Can I talk to the king? Can I talk to the commander of the army? What do you want me to do? Can I help you out? Do you a favor? That's basically what he's saying. Can I do you a favor? And she answered and said, I dwell among my own people, in verse 13. Now that means, maybe she means that I dwell with the people who take care of us. You know, we're well off. You know, there's nothing that you really need to do for us. And so he said, what then is to be done for her? He says that to his servant. Gehazi answered, well, actually, she has no son. And her husband's old. Now the other woman had two sons. This woman has no son. And the servant says, she has no son. And her husband is old. And so he said, well, call her. And when he had called her, she stood in the doorway. And then he said, about this time next year, you shall embrace a son. And she said, oh, no, my Lord. Man of God, do not lie to your maidservant. Don't get my hopes up. My husband's old. That can't happen. Does that sound like anybody that you know? Yeah, it sounds like Abraham and Sarah, don't they? It sounds like them because when God said that to them, they laughed. Come on. You're kidding me. Don't lie to me. You know, don't get my hopes up. That's what she's saying here. But the woman did conceive in verse 17. And she bore a son when the appointed time had come, of which Elisha had told her right through the day. And the child grew. And now it happened one day that he went out to his father to the reapers. Uh-oh, you know something. That doesn't sound good, does it? And he said to his dad, look at this. My head! My head! Tell that to a doctor. You know what the doctor will tell you. Something going on up there. It sounds like a person who's got a tumor, doesn't it? Terrible headache. My head! My head! So he said to the servant, carry him to his mother. Get him back to the house. And when he had taken him and brought him to his mother, he sat on her knees till noon and died. She went up and she laid him on the bed of the man of God. She went up to the guest room and put him in Elisha's guest quarters. And she shut the door upon him. And she went out and then she called to her husband. And she said, please send one of the young men and one of the donkeys, that I may run to the man of God, and come back. And so he said, why are you going to him today? What are you going to the man of God today for? It's neither the new moon nor the Sabbath, meaning usually the prophets ministered and instructed their students on the new moon and the Sabbath, and you could know exactly where they were. And you would go there, and they would answer your questions and things like that. And the guy said, well, he's not going to be teaching. Why are you going to go there? This father, does he have any hope for his son? He's not thinking a miracle, is he? No, but the mother says, it is well. Look at that. It is well. It's okay. And then he saddled the donkey, and he said to his servant, drive and go forward. Do not slacken the place for me unless I tell you. And so she departed and went to the man of God at Mount Carmel. And so it was, when the man of God saw her far off, then he said to his servant, Gehazi, look, the Shunammite woman, please run now and meet her and say to her, is it well with you? Is it well with your husband? Is it well with your child? And she answered what? It is well. Now, let me tell you, that is a statement of faith. When her husband said, why are you bothering him? He's not ministering today. She said, it is well. And when he asked her the question, she says, it is well. Let me tell you,
That is faith.
That's faith. And now when she came to the man of God at the hill, she caught him by the feet. But Gehazi came near to push her away. Sort of sounds like Jesus' disciples, doesn't it? When people come to Jesus. But the man of God said, let her alone, for her soul was in deep distress. Now notice that. She says it as well, but her soul's in deep distress. Right? Which is sort of interesting, isn't it? So it's things aren't well when everything is going well. Things can be well even when things are going poorly. Her soul's in deep distress. The Lord has hidden it from me and has not told me. Notice that. The Lord has hidden it from me and has not told me. You see, Elisha usually has a pipeline to the Lord. He usually hears exactly what the Lord has to say, but he's not getting a word right now. Let her come in. I need to find out what's going on. So she said, did I ask a son of my Lord? Did I not say, do not deceive me? So when she comes in, the first thing she says, you know, I never asked you for a son. She didn't tell me what's happened yet. But he knows, doesn't he? You know, I never asked you for a son. I said, don't deceive me. You gave me a son, and now look. Now he's dead. This is how you're going to treat me? He basically says, you've deceived me. And then he said to Gehazi, get yourself ready and take my staff in your hand and be on your way. If you meet anyone, do not greet him. And if anyone greets you, do not answer him, but lay my staff on the face of the child. So he sends his servant there. And the mother of the child said, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, I will not leave you. I'm not leaving this place until you come. I'm staying here till you come. I didn't come here for Gehazi to come. So he arose and he followed her, and the Gehazi went on ahead of them. And then he laid the staff on the face of the child, just like the master told him. And there was neither voice nor hearing. That didn't do anything. Therefore he went back to meet him and he said, the child is not awake. Basically dead. And when Elisha came to the house, there was the child lying dead on his bed, back on his own bed. And he went in there, and he shut the door behind the two of them. Now, this is interesting, because that other miracle took place behind closed doors, didn't it? Now, this miracle is going to take place behind closed doors. Jesus did a lot of miracles behind closed doors, and so did Peter. When there was a dead person and the people were mourning, he'd put them out and he would close the door and he would raise them from the dead. So he closes that door in verse 33 behind the two of them, and he prayed to the Lord. And he went up and he laid on the child, and he put his mouth on his mouth and his eyes on his eyes and his hands on his hands, and he stretched himself out on the child. And the flesh of the child became warm. And then he returned and he walked back and forth in the house. And again, he went up. So he just does it. And the child starts feeling warm and starts walking around, starts pacing. And then he goes up and he does it again. And then the child sneezed seven times, it says in verse 35. Then the child sneezed seven times. And the child opened his eyes, and he called Gehazi, and he said, call this Shunammite woman. And so he called her, and when she came to him, he said, pick up your son. And so she went in, and she fell at his feet, and she bowed to the ground, and she picked up her son, and she went. Now this wasn't the first miracle like this, because Elisha's own master, Elijah, performed a miracle nearly identical. And you know that this is also a miracle that took place, very similar miracle took place in the New Testament. Who remembers the Apostle Paul as he's heading back to Jerusalem? He does a circuit around all the churches that he planted before he heads back to Jerusalem to celebrate a feast. And he stops off at Troas and he preaches. They have a meal and he preaches until midnight. And a young man named Eutychus is sitting in a window and he falls asleep. Paul's boring preaching. Now, if Peter was preaching, you wouldn't have fallen asleep. You died. But Paul's sort of different. Paul's like a doctrinal preacher. He got tired. The kid fell asleep. Now, they were in the third floor of a house. Believe it or not, some houses back in Bible times were as large as 6,000 to 8,000 square feet. I just can't imagine. I've got drawings of these three-floored, multi-court houses. They were equivalent to very nice houses today. And this kid fell out of the third floor window and was dead. And the scripture says in Acts 20:20 that Paul ran down, fell on him, just like Elisha falls on this boy, embraced him, and the life came back to him. Now, I don't want to be so bold. I have to be very careful when I say things like this. But I want to be bold enough to say it, but I don't want to be too bold in this statement. But let me tell you something. If the miracles happened only in the New Testament, I would say, shouldn't they be happening today? And somebody said, well, you know, that was the apostolic period. Hey, they didn't only happen in the New Testament. These kinds of miracles happen in the Old Testament. These happen under the law. If God did this under the law, what would we do under grace? See, this is why I feel that we don't pray with faith and we don't expect God to do miracles. And I think, for the most part, it's the fault of the pastors and the ministers and the preachers. The people out in the pews are dying for us to be praying for them, touching them, laying our hands on them, supplicating with God on their behalf. And we don't do it, and I don't know why we don't do it. Maybe it's fear that nothing will happen. But that's not our problem, is it? Whose problem would that be? That's God's. Not, our job is just to what? To pray. So I really think that if we would just step out in faith and do this more, we can't guarantee results. We wouldn't want to make a public spectacle of it. They did a lot of this behind closed doors. But I think that we should be doing much more of it. Now, that's just my opinion. And that's why I want to pray, have a time of prayer in the next couple of weeks for many people in our class. So that was a great miracle. Now, the third and fourth miracles are found in verses 38 through 41. That's the third miracle, and that is a pottage of stew that is poisoned, and Elisha says, put some salt in there, put some flour in there, and the poison goes out of the stew. Now, if you've ever had food poisoning, and we're not going to read all these, because I want to spend time on the fifth miracle, okay? I know that our time is limited. I've been told I have a time limit today. I'm told by two people. One, our president told me that it's important that the 11 o'clock people get over to the church on time, and that came down from the top. And the second one is that George Smith let me know that I went 2 minutes over the length of the cassette tape last week. So I need to make sure that I can keep my head. Yeah. Have you ever had food poisoning? I have. It was one of the worst experiences I've ever had. I was at the NRB convention, which is the National Religious Broadcasters Convention, without a radio program. And I had eaten lunch at the restaurant and had a corned beef sandwich, and evidently there was something that was poisonous. And that night, I was feeling fine in the afternoon, and that night I went to their major banquet. And 3,000 people at a banquet at the Washington Hilton Hotel where the National Prayer Breakfast is held, and you know, all the big events are held there. And at my table was Stephen Olford, and there was Pat Robertson here, and Jay Vernon McGee here. And suddenly I'm here, and they're all in tuxedos, and everyone's dressed up. And suddenly it just hit me like that, and I just vomited all over the place. And I'd only been married for a couple years, and maybe we weren't even, without even married. I don't even know if I was married. But I remember this, that I went up and borrowed a room a friend of mine went up there and just was as sick and vomiting. There was blood everywhere. I thought I was going to die. Yeah, I was married. I remember this because I remember saying, okay, Lord, I just can't stay awake anymore. I'm closing my eyes and I'm going to die. And I've tried to live the best life I can. I've preached the gospel. I've done everything that I there's nothing that I think that I shouldn't have done that I didn't do. So, Lord, I put my wife and my children in your hands. And I woke up at like 4 o'clock the next morning and called Lynn, and she got her father and had to come over to Washington, D.C. and take me. I was sick for a week. So let me tell you, I know what food poisoning is. And this was food poisoning that was going to affect the School of the Prophets, guys who were members of the School of the Prophets. And so it's important that this, and if you look down there, you'll see that phrase, sons of prophets in there. It's going to wipe out an entire section of the School of the Prophets. And so God uses Elisha to solve that problem. And then in verses 42 through 44, we have another situation where a man came in verse 42 from Baal Shalisha and brought the man of God bread, the first fruits, 20 loaves of barley, and newly ripened grain in his knapsack, and he said, give it to the people that they may eat. Now, there's a famine in the land at this point. And the guy said, man, I can't give this food to all the people. He said, just give it to them. They need to eat. And the guy said, well, we'll take care of all the people that we have. And he said, just start giving it to them. So he gives it to them, and guess what? It multiplies, and there's a lot left over. Does that sound like a miracle that you know about? Multiplication of the loaves? Okay, so those are the third and the fourth miracles. And you can read those, you know, when you get home, just a few verses in. Now we come to the fifth miracle found in chapter 5. And this is the healing of Naaman, the commander of the army of Syria, in verse 1. He was a great man and an honorable man in the sight of his master. His master would have been the king of Syria. Now, notice something about this man. First of all, he's a commander of the army. This means that he is the chief of staff. He's the number one general in the army of Syria. And I believe Ben-Hadad was the king of Syria at this time, and was sort of had a love-hate relationship with Israel. And notice how he's described. He's described as a great man. See, a great man. A great man in the eyes of his master. The king said, this is a great man. He put the welfare of his entire country in this man's hands. He was a great military leader. He wasn't just a commander, but he was a good commander. And then he's called an honorable man. You know, a lot of times kings don't respect people under them, but he respects this man. This man is honorable. He's got integrity. And it says this, which is sort of interesting. It says he was honorable in the eyes of his master. Now look at the rest of verse 1. Because by him, by Naaman, the Lord had given victory to Syria. So the king considered him great because he brought victory after victory for the nation. And guess what? It was all the Lord's doing, and he didn't want to even realize it. These guys were following the God of Baal. These guys were following false gods. And God was giving them the victory, and they didn't even realize that God was responsible for it. And it says in verse 1, he was also a mighty man of valor, which means that he was brave. And he was courageous. But here's where the rub comes. But he was a leper. Now, this doesn't mean that he had leprosy the whole time he was a general, because that would not have happened, because leprosy, the kind of leprosy they had in Bible times, was very contagious. And it was deadly. But what happened is that this man, who had a tremendously successful career, discovers that he has leprosy. So that's what you need to understand. It's like going to the doctor for an annual checkup, and lo and behold, you find something you weren't expecting. And this man discovers that he has leprosy. And can you imagine what that is going to do to this nation? Their number one military leader has leprosy. Leprosy would be equivalent to cancer today. how we would, you know, when you hear the word cancer, it's frightening. Well, we're doing great things with cancer. But in leprosy, that was the way it would have been understood. Now, verse 2 says, and the Syrians had gone out on raids and brought back, a captive young girl from the land of Israel. Now, here's where Israel comes in. They captured a girl, and she's part of the spoils of battle, and they bring her back, and she waited on Naaman's wife. She became a household servant. And she said to her mistress, if only my master were with the prophet, being Elisha, who was in Samaria, the capital of the northern kingdom, for he would heal him of his leprosy. Naaman went in and told his master, told the king. He said, King, thus and thus said the girl who's from the land of Israel. And he said, hey, there's a girl in our house, and she said, if we could get to this prophet, I could be healed. He said, hey, when you have a fatal disease, you'll hang on to any thread of hope, won't you? Or, do you think they're concerned about Elisha? They've never been concerned about Elisha in their lives. But guess what? When you're without hope, you'll try anything. You'll try quack doctors. You'll try quack treatments. You'll do anything. You'll go to faith healers. You know, I was going to mention a name, but no. You have to really watch out what you say from the pulpit nowadays. So he's so desperate, he'll even try the prophet of Israel. So he says to the king, he said, hey, there's this prophet. Now look what the king says in verse 5. Then the king of Syria said, go now and I'll send the letter to the king of Israel. And nowadays we get on the phone and call him. He said, I'll send the letter. So he departed and he took with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 changes of clothing. And then he brought the letter to the king of Israel, Jehoram. Remember him? We met last week. And here's what the letter said. Now be advised, when this letter comes to you, that I have sent Naaman, my servant, to you, that you may heal him of his leprosy. King got it wrong, didn't he? But he figures maybe the other king will know who to send him to. But then look what happens in verse 7. It happened that when the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his clothes. He said, am I God? To kill and make alive? I can't heal anybody. That this man sends a man to me to heal him of leprosy? Therefore, please consider and see. I know what he's up to. He seeks a quarrel with me. I know what this letter is all about. He's using this as a ruse to get us on the outs, and we'll end up in a war. That's what the king of Israel thinks about. Now, isn't it interesting when he gets the letter, and here's this poor man with leprosy bringing the letter, says he needs a healing. What does the king of Israel think about? Himself. That's right. Thinks about himself. Not once does he think, I can't heal him, but I know someone who can. Elisha. Not even once does he think of that. Now, the slave girl up in Syria working for Mrs. Naaman, she thinks of Elisha. And Naaman the leper, he wants to see Elisha. But guess what? The two kings missed the point altogether. They don't even realize they're sort of out of it. They're living in their own little world. See? And so it was when Elisha, verse 8. The king's thinking about international incident. He's not thinking about this guy's health. So it was when Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his clothes, that he sent to the king and he said, why are you torn your clothes? Please let him come to me. And he shall know that there is a prophet in Israel. Then Naaman went with his horses and his chariot, and he stood at the door of Elisha's house. And Elisha sent a messenger to him, saying, go wash in the Jordan seven times, and your flesh shall be restored, and you shall be made clean. Just a word. He doesn't even go out himself. Just says, it's time to go and wash. And he'll be made clean. That's all it's going to take. What's it going to take for this man to be healed? Faith and active obedience, and just do what the prophet says. Obey the voice of the prophet. Obey the words of the prophet. I mean, that's what you're getting out of these books. The prophets speak, we should listen. So what does this man who's dying of leprosy do? Look at verse 11. But Naaman was furious, and he went away, and he said, indeed. I said to myself, he will surely come out to me. And he will stand and call on the name of the Lord, his God, and he'll wave his hand over this place, and he'll heal the leprosy. Are not Abinah and Pharpar, the rivers in Damascus, better than these dirty waters here in Israel? I threw the word dirty in there. Marsh. I could have washed in them and be clean. And he turned and he went away in a rage. Sometimes wasting my time on this nonsense, and he just, in a huff, walks out, leaves. Now, it's very interesting that the general's pride nearly steals his death sentence. Because he doesn't want to do what the prophet said. And we saw a case like this, but it's the opposite, in Jesus' day, where another military man came to Jesus. And he said, I've got someone that's sick. And Jesus said, well, I'll come. He said, you don't have to come. Just say a word. Just say the word. You know, I know it'll happen. Hey, I'm a man who speaks the word. I'm a man of authority. When I speak, people jump. They do what I say. You just say the word and you'll be healed. But this man doesn't come that way. He gets highly offended that the prophet didn't come out to him. And he basically nearly dies as a result of it. Now, verse 13 says, and his servants came near and they spoke to him. Now, this is pretty good when the servant speaks to the general. He said, my father, which means the master, if the prophet told you to do something great, would you not have done it? How much more when he says to you, wash and be clean? If he'd have given you some really intricate instructions and made this thing complicated, you would have really been satisfied and you would have done it. But because he told you to go wash and you'd be clean, that was too simple for you. And here we have a great lesson regarding healing and regarding salvation. We want it to be difficult. We want to work for our salvation. I had a friend who's no longer with us who once said, if a person was told in order to be saved he had to shimmy up a tree backwards and upside down, he would do it. But tell them they can be saved by grace, they won't believe you. They'll reject it. We want something difficult. And it's all so simple. Listen to the word, believe it, act upon it. That's called faith. And so the servant has better sense than the general. And he says, well, boy, you don't do this. And so verse 14, it must have taken. And so he went down, he dipped seven times in the Jordan according to the saying of the man of God, and his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. And he returned to the man of God, he and all of his aides, and he came and he stood before him, and he said, indeed, now I know there is no God in all the earth except in Israel. Now, therefore, please take this gift from your servant. This man gets converted. He says, now I realize the only God is the God of Israel. Yahweh, Jehovah, is the one true and living God. Hey, he's humbled now. He says, take this gift from your servant. But look what Elisha says. As the Lord lives, verse 16, before whom I stand, I will receive nothing. This is how you know when someone's really from the Lord. I will receive nothing. even though he wanted to give it to him, I'll receive nothing. And he urged him to take it. I said, please, please. But he refused. And so Naaman said, then, if not, you won't take a gift from me. Please let your servant, that's me, be given 2 mule loads of earth. I want a couple truckloads of dirt. And give me, you know, now we have the mules pulling the dirt in this case, but I want two pickup trucks of dirt to take back to my land. I want dirt from Israel. This is holy ground. We're standing on holy ground. Hey, how about 2 truckloads of dirt for me? For your servant will no longer offer either burnt offering or sacrifice to other gods, but to the Lord. And so this man is converted, and that is the goal of healing. The goal of healing isn't just to be healed. The goal of healing is to glorify God, that his power can be manifest, and people will say, the Lord, and he alone is God, and all these other gods are fakes. And so he's totally converted. He's the only sacrifice he'll ever make again is to the Lord, Yahweh, Jehovah. But there's a caveat here, and it's a very interesting one. And it's one that I wonder if you've ever read. Because when I read it, it just jumped out the page. And here's what it said. Yet, I will not worship anybody and offer any sacrifice to the Lord. Yet. In this thing, may the Lord pardon your servant. When my master, that would be the king of Syria, goes to the temple of Rimmon to worship there, to worship a false god, and he leans on my hand, and I bow down in that temple of Rimmon. When I bow down in the temple of Rimmon, may the Lord please pardon your servant in this thing. So I'm going to go back, and my king's going to be worshiping false gods, and he's going to have me by the arm and take me into the temple, and when he bows down, he's going to expect me to bow down. He says, will the Lord pardon me for bowing down? That's what Elisha says. Then he said in verse 19, go in peace. Don't worry about it. So he departed from him for a short season. Now, what's going on here? Well, when he bows down, is he going to be worshiping this false god? No. He said he won't. He's only going to worship the one true living God. And Elisha knows that. There are going to be times when you're going to be invited to celebrations, whether it's a wedding celebration, or whether it's a funeral service, or whether it's a brother-in-law's child christening at a church that is not part of your denomination. It may not even be part of the Christian religion. It could be to a Buddhist temple. It may be to a Jewish synagogue. And guess what? You're going to go there, aren't you? Unless you want to offend your whole family and every colleague at work. Although they came to your church when your child got married, you won't go into their temple when their child gets married? You're going to be invited to go there, and guess what? When you go there, there are going to be rituals, religious rituals that go on, and there is going to be prayer that goes on. And you may even be asked to lower and kneel and bow. And that's the situation that this man is in. And he says, what should I do? I'm going to have to do this. And Elisha says, go in peace. Don't worry about it. Now, I want to give you a little bit of my opinion on this thing. I think we can go into these situations without worship. We can get on our knees. We're not going to pray when we do it. Because they're God. In fact, when we get on our knees, what could we do? Pray to our God. If we're not there, guess what? The presence of God isn't even there. By us being there, the presence of God comes into that situation. And then you go into the reception, and guess what that allows? You say, well, this was a very interesting service. I've never been in a Buddhist temple before. And guess what that allows you to do? Share the gospel and witness. So we need to be wise. Now, if you go in there and you start worshiping their God, of course you can't do that. Paul said you can't go into the temple of demons and eat the meal of demons and worship, you know, in one of these cultic temples. And he's talking about worship. And then take the Lord's Supper. He said, you can't do that. You can't serve two masters if you don't serve one. But that's not what they're talking about here. He's talking about going through these perfunctory activities, but his heart is with the Lord. And when he goes back there, guess what he's going to tell his king? The king's going to say, your leprosy's gone. What happened? And he's going to say, Elisha, the prophet of the God of Israel, healed me. And that king's going to know who he serves. But he says, I'm going to have to go through the motions. Is that okay? And Elisha says, you have my blessing. I know that affects some of us, and we have decisions we have to make, and many times we've made wrong decisions. But I think it's okay to do that if you're not going to actually worship in that situation. Well, the story ends, and I'm going to pick up here next week, but the story ends in verses 20 through 27, where Gehazi, Elisha's servant, says, boy, this guy wanted to give him a pile of money. If he won't take it, I'll take it. And we'll see next week how Gehazi gets himself into trouble taking money from this man. Okay, let's pray. Father, I thank you for your word. I thank you that it's practical, even in the 21st century. Lord, help me to explain it clearly each week. But more importantly, help me to live by these precepts. And help each one of us to live by these precepts. Help us, Lord, to be people of faith. Here we saw a man who lost a Syrian who exhibited faith. How much more should we exhibit and trust you for our livelihood, our physical health?